All right, everybody, welcome back to episode number 5, or as I like to say to my friend Pierre Lebrun, le numéro 5, number 5 episode of...
There you go.
I know. Two-Man Advantage is the podcast, and I also like to add this for my good friend Pierre and all of our francophone listeners, le gâteau est sur la table, et j'ai mal à la tête, which means the cake is on the table and I have a headache, but... Anyway,
you're trying to get us more listeners in Quebec and Northern Ontario and New Brunswick.
Well, yeah, of course. Actually, this is a good francophone pocket in Essex, Ontario, too, near Windsor. So it's good to spread the love, and also trying to draw in some of our listeners and readers in Michigan. That's why we've had Craig Custance join us. Well, and plus we like Craig a lot. So welcome, Craig.
I don't trust Craig because he's got the full 60 podcasts there, and you know he's kind of a spy. Right. He comes on your podcast, Scott, to kind of hammer it.
I come on here to sabotage it. Watch, like, yeah. What awful takes and horrible opinions, and, like, lots of stuttering, long drawn out. Yeah, just watch. This is sabotage here.
Well, this, and Pierre, it's our podcast, even though I like to have the last word. It's our podcast. That's why it's called Two Man Advantage. And Craig, I have you on in the hopes that someday, once again, you'll call me to be on your famous podcast, but that never seems to happen. So
am I on the penalty kill, or what's, like, how does this work for the third person in the two man? Like, am I coming out of the box, or what? Like, what is this?
Basically when, if there's an empty net situation or we get up 3 goals, then you can get on the ice. So.
All right. Okay.
I'm really excited to talk to both of you about World Cup of Hockey and Craig's terrific oral history on Team North America in the game against Sweden back in 2016. But Pierre, I want to talk though right off the hop about it's sort of newsy, but it's an ongoing news event, and it has to do with the team in your town, the Toronto Maple Leafs. So just absolutely so much fun to watch, pouring goals in, the power play is off the charts. Austin Matthews on pace for what is it now, 150 goals or something like that, and John Tavares, no problem stepping into the fishbowl that is playing in Toronto. But all of this is being accomplished without William Nylander, one of the key young pieces of that team moving forward. And you addressed this in your Friday notes package. And I wanted to ask both you guys, are you surprised that, you know, the team has done what it's done offensively and just looks so solid without William Nylander? And does it change maybe how this team approaches William Nylander and his future with the team? Because he's an asset, even though he's not playing now, he's an asset now that other teams around the NHL must be going, well, hey, if this isn't going to work out contractually, maybe there's a fit for us. And obviously the one area the Leafs at some point are going to have to address is how they play defense and that defensive roster. And Pierre, let's start with you since you address this, but you know, what do you make of the whole Nylander thing, and has the Leafs start changed your view of how they might approach it?
So which one of the 6 questions that you had in your preamble do you want me to answer? Because I was jotting them down. You started with Matthews. Started with Matthews, and then are you surprised how many goals they've scored? Hold on, let me go back on my list here. I'm looking at my notes. I think you do that because you know it drives me crazy. Now I can't remember what you asked me. But Nylander. Okay, yes, I was in my Friday NHL notebook today. It's sort of the unfortunate overriding story that is juxtaposed to this ridiculous Edmonton Oilers like circa 1980 start by the Toronto Maple Leafs offensively. Still a work in progress, by the way, on the defensive end of things, but Mike Babcock has lots of games left between now and the playoffs to try and figure that out. But man, can they score goals. And I'm waiting for the first Toronto media member to reach out to Wayne Gretzky to ask him if he's worried about his 92 goal NHL record for goals in a season, given the start from Austin Matthews.
Now, Pierre, I know you want to tell the story this morning, but I think that's a very fine idea. Speaking of the
You want to get on that?
I'll get right on that. You know, I mean, listen, the Nylander standoff is, you know, I understand where both sides are. You know, I think the Leafs, because of the upcoming contract negotiations, you know, at some point over the next 10 months with Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner, I don't think the Leafs feel this is a philosophical line in the sand with William Nylander. I think they think it's a mathematical one, that if for every dollar they go north of $6.5 million a year. And by the way, I don't even know that they've offered $6.5 million yet. I think they started at six. They may have gone to 6.25, depending on who you believe. Obviously, neither side is talking. But at some point, I think they're willing to go to 6.5. But I don't know that they want to go much north of that on a long-term deal. And the reason is, I think they feel that for every dollar they spend north of 6.5, that it really starts to take away from their flexibility and what they can do with Marner and Matthews. They may very well end up north of 6.5 to get this done, but you understand from a mathematical salary cap equation. And by the way, no one ever talks about how Jake Gartner is UFA at the end of the year, and he's going to cost at least, I think, $6 million a year. But, you know, it's a puzzle, and they're trying to make it all fit. And from the Nylander perspective, I think it's twofold. I mean, one is that I think the fear is that if they sign for, let's say, $6.5 million a year, then Marner gets 8.5 next summer. And regardless of how you feel of each player, I think they feel that that's a pretty big overlap. And the other one is, of course, the fear of getting traded, because you can't get a no-trade clause until you're UFA age eligible. So lots to chew on here, but one of the things I did in my notebook today is talk to other GMs and agents around the league to get their view on what they think the deal should look like. And really, a lot of it comes down to the same ballpark, you know, anywhere from 6 to 6.6, you know, in that range is where a lot of people think the deal should end up going if it's a long-term deal.
Yeah. Craig, it's interesting, and Pierre sort of, there was an aside almost in Pierre's column, but was either an agent or a GM who noted, hey, listen, you know, this is Kyle Dubas has done a nice job, and he's doing a nice job in handling a very tricky situation for the Maple Leafs. And of course, the new GM having inked John Tavares, he's on a pretty good roll. But Craig, do you see this as a different dynamic for him, and maybe his first, you know, real challenge of, you know, one thing to bring in a unrestricted free agent like John Tavares, but this is homegrown talent. You have to decide, A, can you keep him, and at what price and at what term, all those things. And if not, how do you maximize that asset? Because there will be teams that would be interested, of course, in William Nylander. And can you leverage that into maybe a blue chip defensive prospect or a young defenseman who can step into the lineup and really help this team? Because there are people who believe that this is a team that's not just, you know, they're not just playoff worthy, but they're cup worthy or on the cusp of being cup worthy. And I wonder how you view this as we move forward.
Yeah, it was interesting because the Leafs were here in Detroit last night, and this was naturally a topic of conversation in the media room where, you know, executives and scouts and media all gather and eat. And one person that had been in the Red Wings organization a long time was like, you know, back with the Red Wings, it used to just be like, here's our pie, right? And we would show it to them, and we would say, here's Nicklas Lidström's slice of the pie, and here's Steve Yzerman's, and sorry, Kirk Maltby, this is yours. And that's how it's going to be. But they made the distinction. It was a different scenario for a lot of reasons. One, there was no cap, so this was just kind of internal budget. But the other thing was, you know, the Red Wings had won together, and most of these guys had already made their money. So when you're asking, you know, Luke Robitaille to join the Red Wings late in his career, or Brett Hall or whoever, or even Nick Lidstrom to kind of set the ceiling on his last contract, he'd already made his money. And you know, which is a completely different scenario with these kids in Toronto who, A, they haven't won together yet. So it's not like you're trying to keep the band together that you know is successful. Like, we're all just kind of projecting here. And you know, they still haven't had their big contracts yet. So I think it's a completely different scenario. To me, Kyle Dubas is of the general manager breed that looks at players less emotionally than, you know, I use this because it's the extreme example. And let's say Dean Lombardi, who was super emotional and loyal and you know, he was kind of the opposite. Like, I think Kyle Dubas is of the mentality that you have a portfolio. And you have certain, you know, there's certain costs that come with these players, and it's almost like stocks. Like, if this one is, you can't overpay for it. It's good, even if it's a great stock, you can't overpay for it, or else it's not worth what you're paying. And And I think there's just, you know, and kind of watching the way that Kyle Dubas has operated and what he has said in the past, I feel like there's a certain level of almost, I don't want to say detachment because it sounds cold, but I think that's just how he's going to operate. And it's going to be fascinating because Pierre's right. You've got this one. And then, of course, Austin Matthews is watching this. And then you have Mitch Marner laying in the weeds, who's going to watch, my sense is going to wait till Austin signs to see what he's going to do. So there's so much riding on one thing. And they can't overpay. But I love, I don't know if you guys saw in The Athletic, Tyler Dello did a story essentially about the leverage that Nylander has that continues to grow, because this is such a big season for the Maple Leafs, because you have some of these salaries low. So you only have so many of these seasons where these guys are making low money and you have to capitalize, and you don't want to lose one of those pieces for the entire season as that December deadline gets closer.
Well, I guess, no one seems to be really discussing, well, if it's not going to work here, then it'll have to work somewhere else for William Nylander. Are we not nearly at that point yet? Like, and I'm not suggesting that the Leafs should abandon this and, you know, and try and pry Colton Parayko or whoever it is. You know, Parayko's name, you know, came up a few times for teams looking, obviously, to, you know, to add a terrific young defenseman. The Blues looking to add some offense, which they did in the offseason through various means. But is that, you know, Pierre, is that a, you know, how realistic do you think that kind of option is to say, listen, let's take this asset and let's address one of our big needs? Or is it too early to be worrying about that, do you think, especially with the Leafs off to a terrific start point-wise?
Well, first of all, I don't think that top four right-handed unicorn defenseman is there right now for the Leafs. Right. I mean, they need that player. They're going to want that player. They're going to try and get that player at some point, but I don't know that he's available right now this early in the season. So,
right. Yeah.
But aside from all that, I have to take Kyle Dubas to his word when I hear from other GMs around the league saying that what they're being told from the Leafs is that Nylander isn't available. I mean, right. I don't know that he would say that just for the heck of it. Now, I suppose if this thing dragged on another 3-4 weeks, maybe that would have to be revisited. But I think that's the feeling right now from the Leafs is, you know, you got a first-year GM who probably doesn't want to open his account by having to trade away a guy that he couldn't sign, I mean, is my guess. And but, you know, again, I think that whatever you frame the situation on one day certainly has a danger of changing as this goes on, and for many reasons. But it's fascinating to be sure because, you know, William Nylander's father, Michael Nylander, whom the three of us covered when he was a player, he was a really talented player. Mm-hmm. He was also very headstrong. And famously, I remember working at the Canadian Press one summer when he agreed to a deal with the Edmonton Oilers and then reneged on it. And it became a gong show. And he ended up signing for much less money in Washington. And again, you know, you're the father and the son are not the same human being. It's hard to believe that Michael Nylander isn't in his son's ear, at least in terms of advice. I mean, for sure, that would be a factor right now. And probably saying, you know, stick to your guns here. And, you know, I didn't put it in my column today, but I had one agent who kind of went on a kind of a tangent with me on the phone and said, you know, everyone sees the market as being, you know, between 6 and 6.75 million a year for Nylander, but it's not against the rules for BF to be asking more than that. I mean, at the end of the day, Mike Liu, the agent, got, you know, north of $8 million for Leon Draisaitl. Yeah. And everyone believes that contract, you know, $8.5 million a year, times eight. And everyone, all the teams around the league say, well, that contract doesn't count. It's an outlier.
Yeah, they want to throw that one out.
It doesn't count because you hate it. So, again, I mean, I think I totally get where the Leafs are coming from and the puzzle and the math and why the Nylander deal has to fit with everything else they're doing. But it's not against the rules what the Nylander camp and agent Lewis Gross are doing. I mean, the market is what you make it.
And this is why it's always such a treat to work with you, Pierre, because we work without a script, as you know. Like, I'm not, you know, I always like to throw four or five questions. You pick one that you want to answer or none, and whatever. But your mention of Leon Draisaitl allows us to shift gears slightly. And Craig, you and I were talking about this earlier this week, and Pierre, even before we started to tape this morning, talking about the Edmonton Oilers, who it seems like the league, you know, the regular season's been going for what, about a month now, and the Oilers have played two games, and it's not quite that bad, but it's just such an interesting dynamic for me, with both New Jersey and Edmonton having been in Europe to start the regular season, and unlike all of the, I went back and I looked. And if I'm, unless I'm mistaken, all of the premier games or all of the regular season games that have been, that the NHL has put on in Europe, there's been two games. So I remember years ago, I did Tampa, the New York Rangers. They played two games in Prague. Pierre, I know you were in, I think, both in Finland and in Sweden for premier games, if I'm not mistaken, during in the past. But basically, the model has been.
Even London, England.
London, you and I were both in London, England, at the O2 Arena in London, the Anaheim, LA. And those, so the pattern has been, go there, you play an exhibition game, maybe two, and then you play two regular season games. Then you come home and you try and figure out, you know, how you're going to readjust to being back in North America. The Devils and the Oilers played just one game. And for Edmonton, so now they came back and they worked this out with the league. And I understand the dynamic of not coming back from Europe, going all the way out west to Edmonton, and then, you know, picking up with game two. So they stayed in the Eastern time zone, but it's been a long, you know, sort of period of time where they haven't played games. Their second game, and Craig, you and I talked about it, predictably, they get snowballed by the Boston Bruins. So now they've lost both games. They're off, as we're talking today, another day off, just what they need, before playing a matinee on Saturday against the New York Rangers and then moving on with their schedule. And Craig, I just wonder if that's a tough way to start for a team that really desperately needed to put a horrific season behind them and get off to a good start. And it hasn't happened that way. And you know, obviously the scheduling hasn't helped them.
No, I thought it was brutal. And there's a sitting there, you know, and when you're talking to people with Edmonton, like they, you know, you had the option of going back to Edmonton, but then you're flying back over there, readjusting to that time zone, flying back to the East and readjust. So kind of they made this call to get East and hang out. And it was a bit reminiscent to me of like the team that wins a playoff series and sweeps while the other one's going seven games and is flying, and then they got to play that game. You know, Boston, the Oilers are just sitting there, and if you and I were smart and it was legal and ethical, like that was such a lock for the Oilers to lose that game, right? To bet that, like, it was, of course they're gonna lose that game. And you're right, Scott. I just thought it was, I thought the schedule, like, these teams are not gonna want to go to Europe to start the season any more than they don't want to now if this is gonna be how the schedule is done. I thought it was brutal.
Pierre, like, I know that there's a lot. Apparently there was no scheduling issue, but maybe it was an issue. You know, it costs money to go there, all those kinds of things. But I think Craig's point is a good one. If you're going to do these kinds of events, it can't be punitive to, right? You can't have these things where all of a sudden teams are like, oh my God, the last thing I want to do is do it that. I don't want to do what the Oilers did.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think back to the Senators last year, came back from Sweden, and everything went off the rails from that moment on for Ottawa. Now, that probably isn't the number one reason, but still, if you start to collect evidence as to all of it, I mean, I don't know. I love going over to cover those events over the years, but I have to say that when those games were played, and there's more coming, the Jets are going to Finland, but I thought that the buzz was pretty muted for these games overseas this time around. And, you know, I mean, the league is committed, I think, to going back next year. But I just wonder whether it's overstayed its welcome as an event, or, you know, maybe it's like the outdoor games now, where when you're watching the outdoor games on TV now, you're like, you know, yeah, you know, been there, done that. But when you're at the event, it's still an event, right? When we're hosting a Winter Classic. So maybe that's what it is for the European games, that when you're there, there's still a buzz. And of course the point is to reach out to a whole marketplace that you don't get to reach out to during the season.
Yeah. Well, to me, like, and if you're going to do it, why not do, like, it doesn't make, to me, it makes zero sense for both New Jersey. Now, it hasn't hurt New Jersey. Of course, they're coming off a crushing victory over the Washington Capitals, so it didn't hurt right. them. Now they got to come home, so they didn't have to, you know, they haven't been sitting in a hotel. Like, the Oilers have been in hotels now for probably the better part of 2 weeks. So, but to me, why not have sort of, is there a way to do like a mini tournament? Maybe you have, you know, maybe you have a bunch of central division teams and you go and you've got four teams in one city and you play over the course of 3 days or 4 days, you play two or three games or whatever it is. But there's, it's got to, if you're going to keep doing it, there's got to be a better way to do it. But, you know, again, Pierre and I, you and I were talking about this, but it's not cheap, right? These things don't come for free. So you have to decide what the balance is, what the benefit is, but it does seem like it's, could use some tinkering if we're going to keep moving forward with it.
Well, do you guys remember like the first, whatever it was, five or six coaches to go over there were fired? Do you guys remember? The number was astounding to the point. I remember when I first moved back to Detroit, the Red Wings were playing in somewhere, and I kind of made a joke to Mike Babcock in the scrum. My question was along the lines of like, do you fear for your job since the last six guys to go over there? And like, he was pissed. Like, he did not like that question. And I'm like, of all the guys in the world, like, Mike, it's so, you know, he was coming off, you know, multiple trips to the finals. I'm like, this guy should probably not be fearing his job. But I guess coaches don't like joking around about job security. But I just do remember every coach was on the line for a while there that started their season in Europe.
Yeah, that's good. We'll slide towards the end of the first segment of Two Man Advantage, the podcast. But the other sort of news of the day that I was curious to get both of your takes on, it involves Austin Watson and his suspension by the league as a result of a domestic violence incident, initially given a 1/3 of the season suspension, 27 games. Arbitrator Shyam Das will reduce that to 18 games. Craig, let's start with you. That basically he's reduced it by a third. So, surprised by that? Does it maybe suggest that the NHL needs to take another look at, along with the NHLPA, of course, at having a domestic violence policy in place, not unlike what we've seen with the performance-enhancing drug policy, where there are some, you know, some guidelines, a structure. You know, we talked about Nate Schmidt getting 20-game suspension, regardless of, you know, he tested positive for a very small amount, but that's the system is in place, and that's 20 games. That's what he got. Is there something? Does the NHL need to have something like that in place for issues of with domestic violence? Or what's your take on the whole Austin Watson thing?
I'm very much in camp. There needs to be a spelled out policy in this, and with the same kind of zero tolerance attitude that you know Nate Schmidt had to deal with, like this. You get 1/1,000,000th of whatever 1% of a banned substance, you're out 20 games. Like, to me, this we should be handling this the same way. Like, if there's zero room for this, if you know you fall out of line, there's minimum. We're not gonna be debating this like a borderline hit along the boards. You know what I mean? Like, I think there should be very, and maybe, I don't know, maybe that's not, I'm sure they've talked about this at higher levels than this, but this should be pretty spelled out with set guidelines. No? Yeah. Is that unreasonable?
No, I don't think so. Pierre, what's your...
No, I mean, I think the only thing that I don't know. I mean, this is so out of our depth in terms of our expertise. When you're talking about something this serious and legal. But I think that is every offense of this nature judged the same. I want to be careful how I say this, but
of course,
from what we're hearing from different people, it certainly seems like the Slava Voynov incident was quite serious, right?
Yeah.
By all accounts. So I guess my point is, at the end of the day, you know, domestic abuse is domestic abuse, and we can't have any time for it, period, in the NHL or any league or anywhere in life. But should the incidents not still be looked at for the degree of seriousness the actions that occurred? So I guess that's the only thing I would say here, is that you probably still need to look at every incident for what they are.
Right. But and maybe this, maybe there's a way to, you know, that both those ideas come into play. But I think Craig's point is a good one, that, okay, if you have, you know, you have a system in place for performance enhancing drugs, why wouldn't you have something in place for something that is much more serious and much more problematic? And acknowledging that these things may happen, right? So you have to be prepared for them. And I think it's important that there is some sort of structure in place, and that you then move forward from that based on whatever the circumstances are with every specific event. But you have a policy in place that says, okay, here's we have a zero tolerance policy. Here's where the thresholds are for supplemental discipline and all those kinds of things, and move forward from there. Craig, let me ask you one more quick question on that. Were you surprised that Austin Watson was on the ice and introduced with the team? I know there were a lot of people on social media they were a bit surprised that when the Preds introduced their 2018-19 team, that he was in uniform and on the ice. Were you troubled by that, or what was your thought on that?
I don't know about surprise. I just want these teams to realize, or I hope they're taking in consideration that the message, when you just kind of rally the troops and you're like, this guy is part of our group and this is family or whatever, the kind of the message that comes out of here, just be aware what message it's also sending to people in your fan base, right? Like, that's all. Like, I don't know. Pierre's right. Like, it's hard to talk about because we don't know all the facts, and so you don't want to sit there and. But like, it sometimes looks callous to me when you're like, hey, you know, hey, mistakes were made, and let's. I don't know. I think you got to be careful what message you're sending when you do stuff like that.
Yeah. No. Couldn't agree more. All right. We will, in fact, return after a brief break for the second segment of Two Man Advantage, the podcast. And as promised, we're going to talk about the greatest game ever played. At least that's what I read in The Athletic, as it refers to Team North America and Team Sweden. So don't go away. We'll be right back. All right, here we are back for the second segment, Two Man Advantage, the podcast. Craig, I know you've got work to do, and actually, I want to ask you about the story you're going to write before you go, if that's all right. But first of all, as advertised, I thought your oral history piece on the game at the 2016 World Cup of Hockey, Team North America, Team Sweden, was fabulous. And we were together in Chicago during the player tour when you were asking some of the players who were involved in that game about it. And I'm going to get to you, but Pierre, I'm going to ask you the very first question on this topic. Which game was more meaningless, Team Sweden and Team North America 2016, or Team USA, Team Russia shootout game, preliminary round, Sochi Olympics 2014? Which game was ultimately more meaningless?
I mean, listen, I like what Craig did. I mean, listen, ultimately the game was meaningless in the scope of nothing having been won. But I think it's historical because of the players that it involved. I mean, that's the difference. I mean, I think when you're talking Olympics, the only thing that matters is winning medals. Yeah. I mean, that's no offense to TJ Oshie and that wonderful moment in that preliminary round game. But at the end of the day, who cares?
That was for the gold, right? Us in America.
Yeah, exactly. So, but this is different because I think that, you know, one of the things that you'll always remember very much so after the terrific job that Craig did to relive it is what a launching point it was for so many of these guys. And, you know, not just the young Austin Matthews, who hadn't even played an NHL game yet. And of course, Connor McDavid. But, you know, I remember thinking about Nathan MacKinnon. What a great way for him to come back onto the stage, because he had already come into the league and with a lot of buzz, but then his sophomore year was a bit so-so. And then I remember thinking during that tournament, everyone went, oh, yeah, don't forget about him. And, boy, ever since, I mean, really, Nathan MacKinnon, as we know, probably, you know, he was my Hart Trophy vote last year. I have no problem with Taylor Hall winning, but that's one of the things I remember too from Team North America is the Nathan MacKinnon return party too.
Yeah, no, there's no question. Anyway, Craig, when you were putting it together, were there things that surprised you just in terms of how people remembered it? Or I have to tell you, I was a bit surprised Pleasantly so, of course. But like people loved to remember that, like on social media, like when people were talking about that story and the video clips, people came up, you know, like, yeah, it was a great game, but like, okay, that game. And to me, I remember that game because at the end of it, they completely had misunderstood how the tournament worked, right? They thought they had guaranteed themselves a move on to the elimination round. And of course, they needed to win in regulation, and they didn't. And basically, by winning in overtime, they were pretty much pooched, right? They had almost no chance.
Finland team wasn't going to beat Russia.
Exactly. They needed Russia to lose to Finland, and that wasn't going to happen. But was there anything that surprised you when you were putting it together?
I knew I was onto something, and you guys saw this when I saw the reactions of the players when we started throwing. It wasn't like, why are we talking about this game? It was, oh my gosh, I love that game. You know, and Austin Matthews saying, I remember every second of it, and being able to recall. Oh, I mean, we were sitting with Scott, you were there with Jack Eichel, and I love the line where he's like, yeah, I just bought a house, and the only thing hanging is a team picture from Team North America. And I'm like, all right. I forgot that. Because like that was one of those stories where you kind of drop a line in the water, and I'm sure you guys do this all the time, where you're like, I think I want to do this. I think it's a good idea. Let me ask a couple questions. And when there was complete buy-in from the players involved, I'm like, oh yeah, we're on to something here. And like you said, Scott, the response on social media and the numbers with The Athletic of people reading it was incredible. And so like this afternoon, I've got all this great audio, so I'm going to try to figure out a way to splice it together in the Full 60 podcast and try to, you know,
what's
tell the
that?
Story the same way. It's a rival podcast. That would be arch rival. You can get it on iTunes and Stitcher if you're listening to this later this weekend. So yeah, so it was great. And I was so glad. So like I'm sitting there later today on The Athletic, we're going to post, you know, what a team North America would look like in 2018, just because the response was fun and we're having a good time with it. And I was so glad that Pierre actually did some reporting on this, but while I'm doing like fictitious rosters and reliving a meaningless game, I was so glad to see that Pierre, because this had occurred to me, I just didn't have make the effort to see, oh yeah, are we going to do this again? And I was glad you did that, Pierre. And you can tell people what you found out.
Well, you were the inspiration, my friend. So there you go. We work well as a team, but because you know, it's just sort of been hanging out there as this idea that is this going to happen again or not? And we've talked about it a million times, but they're actually now coming towards a deadline where they have to fish or cut bait. And so both sides, both the NHL and NHLPA, I had sources on both sides yesterday indicate that they need to figure this out by early January, either way, whether they're having a tournament in 2020 or not. And what surprised me in some of the things that I heard in these phone calls that I had is that they're throwing around a lot of different ideas to get around the idea of not wanting, obviously, a lockout as soon as the tournament ends in September 2020, in case there's a reopener of the CBA. And one of the ideas is, do we change the timing of the CBA or do we extend the CBA? Do we, you know, like all these different things where I'm like, wow, there's some pretty positive ideas being thrown around. Now, it doesn't mean they're going to happen. It may very well be that old habits die hard and that they can't see eye to eye and they just decide to cancel the tournament. But at least I think both sides want to hold this tournament again. And because of that, they're trying to come up with some progressive ideas to make sure they can have it without any negativity. So let's see.
Did you happen to ask if there would be a Team North America 2020?
I did not. As you may remember, as the tournament was wrapping up in 2016, I did put out a thing where the league was kind of leaning towards not bringing it back. And I know it sounds counterintuitive given how popular the team was, but I think in many ways that's the point. Is that might be a once in a lifetime opportunity when you get guys like Matthews and McDavid and Eichel and McKinnon on the same team. And, you know, would it take away from it if you tried to do it again? But who knows? Maybe they'll change their mind on that given the popularity of the team.
Well, I want to ask both you guys, because I know, you know, part of the lead in into the 2016 World Cup of Hockey was that they structured it the way they did with the Team Europe and with Team North America, because they wanted to be more compact and they wanted as many top NHL players in that tournament as they could get. And that meant freezing out nation teams like Switzerland and Germany and Slovakia, and teams that we see regularly at the World Championships and certainly at the Olympics. And the idea was that next time around, in presumably 4 years later in 2020, that it would be more like an Olympic-style tournament and more like the Canada Cup tournaments that were really the sort of the genesis of the World Cup of Hockey. But is there not a way, given the popularity of Team North America, and you can do it, you know, like it really hurt Team USA, right? I mean, there were a bunch of, you know, top young American players that would have been vying for spots on the misguided and ill-fated Team USA in 2016. So you don't want to have that again. But isn't there a way to do it so that you could still have that same kind of buzz, you know, whether it's the Hughes brothers or, you know, think about there's always another generation of terrific mm-hmm. young players, right? You know, isn't there, you know, Craig, if you were running the World Cup of Hockey 2020, would you set it up so that there is a Team North America, and let's say you grandfather, so Austin Matthews, I don't know, whatever the age cutoff, so he might still be under it, could grandfather him. Yeah, so you grandfather him into Team USA because he's already played for Team North America. So you can't do it twice. Basically, that's the rule. But you unleash another Team North America. Surely there'd be enough good players, wouldn't there? Or do you think it is just a once in a lifetime thing?
I would run it back, and just because it added such a wrinkle, and with the caveat. And so I actually had this discussion yesterday with Dylan Larkin. So we had this graphic with all the players we put on this year's Team North America. I'm like, what do you think? And it, of course, included Dylan, and he's like, oh my gosh, this would be great. And then then I turned the recorder off. We were just chatting, and I'm like, yeah, you know, would this ever happen? And I'm like, you know, Team USA really would need, if you're having the World Cup and you don't have Austin Matthews and Jack Eichel on Team USA and even like Seth Jones and Zach Werenski,
yeah,
like that's the heart of the team. And I just don't think you could do that on some level. And Dylan was like, how about you just have like the alumni exemption? So if you played on Team North America in 16, you're ineligible to play on it in 2020.
Right. Exactly.
And now, you know, now you're talking about a whole different group of guys, and it's, you know, maybe it's a Brock Besser and some of the guys that you mentioned, right? And Clayton Keller or whatever it is, Charlie McAvoy, guys that yep. maybe would be in the conversation for the national team. But as were some of these players anyways, Connor probably would have made Team Canada. But I think I would run it back. And I guess it's unfair to whatever country you're cutting out of the equation. But I would run it back just because it was so fun and it was nostalgic. And I think it made the tournament different. I thought it was so well received. That became one of the biggest stories of that tournament. And here we are 2 years later, still talking about that. We're not talking about Team Europe or Team Canada and that won it. And I think I would run it back.
Yeah,
I totally disagree. And I think the reason is, if you bring back the World Cup in 2020, you want it to feel like a terrific best on best run up to the Beijing Olympics, which presumably, hopefully, the NHL will participate in. And I think with that in mind, you know, Switzerland was really the country that got screwed out of the World Cup in 2016, and they're a terrific hockey country with a lot of NHL players and a lot of good players in the Swiss League. I think it's unfair to have Switzerland knocked out again. And I think that you want a more traditional setup for the next World Cup because it'll give you a good idea and a good sense and something to compare to what happens in that tournament to what happens in Beijing. And I think that's, you need to go back. And listen, I completely agree that Team North America remains the story. I mean, it's like, let's put it this way. They're almost nothing more boring than Canada winning again in that tournament because that's all they did for the last 10 years in that messed up mess. So North yeah. America was way more exciting a storyline. But I think it's a one-off. I think it's a once-in-a-lifetime thing where you had generational players come together and make up that team, and I don't know that you can find the magic again that way. And listen, I could be wrong, and it's actually rare for Craig and I to disagree on something like that.
I know.
I've think
got to rethink my stance.
Well, I just think that with Beijing in mind, that you want to set up the rotation now with best on best. And you know, maybe Austin Matthews leads Team USA to World Cup glory in 2020. And then Connor McDavid returns Canada to glory in Beijing. Like, to me, the storylines are more traditional and more outstanding that way.
Well, okay. And, you know, I like to sort of I'm a fence kind of guy. What if you just expand the pool? A, don't have, like, I would have zero exhibition games. Like, I would not do any, or maybe one. But maybe you could expand your, you know, what do we have, 8 teams last time? What if you went to 10, figured out your schedule from that? Then and I'm with you, Pierre. I thought it was unfortunate for Switzerland. I know, you know, the Slovaks felt that, you know, Czech Republic had a team. Why not Slovakia? You know, I mean, you could do a couple different things. Germany's in the mix as well. Maybe you expand it so that you can have more country representation, but you also have a Team North America part deux, if I can say, part two. Maybe you can work at both. And what about this? What about having some games in Seattle? I'm just saying, right? Lead into. Yeah,
so, like, I don't know.
That's a great idea.
Pierre, I got the sense in talking to other, like, to people about this, and I, again, I don't know if anything's been decided, but if there is a 2020 World Cup, it may be more spread out across the world. I don't know.
Right.
Maybe I'm jumping the
game. Well, that's something they did in 2004, as some of you may remember, and I felt like they thought it was a bit unwieldy, but who knows? I mean, at the end of the day, I love the Seattle idea, but I also love involving Europe. And by the way, I think now you're on the hook, Craig, since you've done this amazing job on remembering Team North America from that tournament. You may want to give a nod to the team, to the other mixed team that actually made it to the final, which is Team Europe.
the oral history of Mark Strait, and I don't even remember who was that. Could you name 3 Team Europe players?
Well, no, yeah. And the thing is, they actually, I don't know if Canada was bored by then, but they gave Canada a run. In the final, like, those games were competitive. Everyone had left their hotels and gone home from Toronto by then because they thought the tournament was over before that final was played.
That was so, like, there's a couple of things there. Like, one, and I'd forgotten this, but, like, after I wrote that story, a lot of people from Toronto were like, I got that ticket for like $10 and it was the best thing I ever did. And I forgot, like, attendance was kind of a thing. Like, I think it was the price was really high. And so I think that's a consideration when you're figuring out where to host it. But, like, the Team Europe, the thing I remember most was Ralf Kruger and how he became this fascinating character in that tournament, the coach of Team Europe. And Chris Jones was our colleague at ESPN. And so we'd all divvy those up, and that was his team. And we would just sit and talk about Ralf Kruger over beers for hours. Like, he became the most fascinating man in the world during that whatever it was, 1 month stretch.
Yeah, and I'll only say when I talk to the players, and because you always get mixed, sort of, like, I think for us it was a mixed bag in large part because, you know, even though the games were on ESPN, Team USA was such a, they went winless. I mean, it was a disaster in terms of what the NHL and everyone had hoped for, I think, in terms of profile and that. And so it was disappointing on so many fronts. But I'm always amazed when I talk to players who played in that tournament, they loved it. Like, they loved and part of what they loved, I think, was that the tournament itself was in one place. And obviously, being in Toronto, they didn't have to move around a lot. You know, the exhibition games were in different cities, but once the tournament started, they were locked down, and they really liked that part. So I think that will be part of the balance in terms of what the NHLPA is looking for. Because I think my sense of it is the players really liked having the tournament in one location, and that was the focal point of the whole thing. So you'd have to, like, I get it. Right? You want the building filled, but the players also like the idea of not having to, you know, bounce around like they are so often during the regular season. So lots of different things there.
Yeah, it's a pity for Team USA in that tournament. They didn't have a separate just shootout competition. Maybe they could learn that.
Oh, gosh. What a disaster that was. Oh, my gosh. I don't even want to talk about that Team USA. The last thing I'll say before you, I know I can already sense I've done enough of these. You're ready to go to the next segment, Scott. But the last thing is, the legend has it, and I've never been able to pin down what exactly was said, that Dean Lombardi, before I guess it would have been Team USA's first game, gave
against Team Europe
speech in the history of, like, pregame or pre-tournament speeches. That was, like, guys wanted to run through the wall. Like, it was like General Patton. Was he, I don't know, was he inspirational? But, you know, like, apparently it was unreal. And I want, one day I'm going to figure out what that speech was.
Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously it didn't work.
I was going to say they got beat by Team Europe in the first game, and really from that moment on, the tournament was a wash, right? Because they had to beat, the way it was set up, they had to beat Team Europe in game one, and they didn't do it. And anyway, the rest is history. Craig, I know you have work to do, and so we will cut you loose, and Pierre and I will mop up, just kind of like always for us. We'll mop up after you're gone.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. And listeners, make sure you listen to the full 60. Subscribe, download first.
See you guys. See you. All right. Well, we're going to forge on here, Pierre. You know what? There was a question I wanted to ask you last week, and I wanted to ask Craig too, but now he's gone. He works very hard. He's going off to work on a story about the.
Well, you better not say it in case you. Well, I was going to say you better not sell it in case it doesn't come out.
Well, that's true. Well, whatever. Next time we have him on, we'll talk about it. But I wanted to ask you last week, and I forgot to, well, we ran out of time. I didn't forget. But we had to put our predictions in for the end of the season, Stanley Cup winners and stuff. I was just curious. What did you end up? Who'd you end up with?
Yeah, I didn't. First time in my career, I didn't make picks. It's interesting. I just, you know what?
You didn't do it? You didn't fill in the form?
No, I didn't. I don't know what happened.
You're kind of a rebel. You're kind of a rogue. Okay, so you didn't even.
You know, I'm not very good at predictions anyway, and it's not really what I get paid to do. So I was like, you know what? Who cares what I think? Yeah,
I know. Yeah. Okay,
but so I either want, but I have two dream matchups. I either want San Jose, Tampa Bay, because those teams are awesome, and it'd be perfect weather for the Cup Finals.
Yes,
or
I like that. Yeah.
Or Winnipeg, Toronto, an all-Canadian final with two juggernaut teams. And, of course, it would guarantee Canada would finally end its Stanley Cup drought. So yes. Those are the two two Cup final matchups that I'd like to see. Not a mix of those. Either Tampa, San Jose.
Yep.
And or Winnipeg, Toronto.
All right. Well, that's good. Well, I'm glad. I'm a little disappointed you did not follow the instructions sent out by the bosses at the Athletic, and I hope no one from the Athletic is listening to this to find out that you, in fact, failed to do that. See, I put mine in because I'm dutiful, and my son continues to mock me because every year I pick the Capitals to win, and finally, you know, like the blind squirrel, I got the nut last year when the Capitals won.
Right.
I think I had Edmonton in the final, though, because anyway, so I think both my Western final prediction teams missed the playoffs. I had Dallas and Edmonton. They both missed the playoffs entirely. But I did have the Capitals winning, and I had them going back to the final only because I just couldn't think of who else. I know Tampa's really, really good. But I just thought, you know what? Washington's a good team, so they could make it. And in the same Washington vein, I have Nashville winning, and probably because I love to go to Nashville, so maybe that's it too. But I had Nashville coming back in and finally getting it right. So that was my pick. So
lots of emotion last night in that Nashville Winnipeg rematch. Woo!
Oh my gosh!
Tell you what, those teams don't like each other.
Yeah, that was and you and I covered that series, the second round series, seven games.
We did.
That might have been the best series of the playoffs, dude.
I think it's the best. It's the best series that I've personally covered in my 24 years covering the NHL. Probably the best series I've covered since one of those Detroit Pittsburgh Cup Finals.
Yeah,
that was amazing hockey. Yeah,
yeah. No, it was really good, and it's, you know, long way to go, but it's I can't imagine that at some point next spring, we won't see Winnipeg Nashville part two. Like it seems.
Well, we'll see. I mean, it looks that way, but the Central is crazy. St. Louis and Dallas are improved, and you never know with that veteran Chicago team. And I don't know. It's, you know, this is a league where you start counting ahead and thinking ahead and everything on paper, and then it embarrasses you because the league is so close. So who knows?
Do it. All right. So before we close, I think it's been so much fun. First week and a half, we're closing in on the first 2 weeks of the regular season. I love the moment in Chicago and the Leafs, and Austin Matthews cupping his hand to his ear after he scored, and then Patrick Kane answering back moments later and doing the same thing. And you could see Matthews smiling on the bench. Like, how much fun was that? And how much, you know, I love how the Carolina Hurricanes have, you know, they celebrating in a different fashion, and they're off to a terrific start, and really engaging the fans in Raleigh. And there's been so much fun, and a lot of, to me anyway, it just seems like there's so much vibrancy and so much personality. And I wonder, are there things, you know, has there been a moment where you're like, oh, you know, this is fun. I can't, you know, I'm so glad it's back. Or has there been a moment or a, you know, something that you've been looking at going, yeah, this is, I'm glad we're back in the groove now.
Well, first of all, I knew you'd mention the Hurricanes because you have Stockholm syndrome.
But, I didn't even say I had stock in that team.
Yeah.
Undefeated in regulation as we speak right now.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's hard. I mean, nothing can top what Austin Matthews is doing right now. I mean, come on. I mean, that's just ridiculous. 9 goals in 5 games and just the way in which he's scoring goals from different areas. And you know, it's just so difficult to score goals in this league. And the work that he's put in every summer to improve his ability to shoot and shoot from different areas. I mean, it's just such a treat to watch him right now. On the negative side, I mean, I think I wrote about this Tuesday morning for us at The Athletic, but boy, I've got a big focus on the Vegas Golden Knights. You know, you knew when you looked at the schedule that things would be harder for them in year two, but, you know, to be where they are right now, and now the injury to Paul Stastny, and I sensed a lot of angst there from the GM on down when I was there Monday in Buffalo after they lost to the Sabres. So I think the Golden Knights, you know, are our story right now as well, not for the reasons they're accustomed to, but it'll be interesting to see how they come out through this adversity.
Yeah, well, and they're coming, as you and I were talking, they're coming off another disappointing performance. Back to back, right? I mean, they were schooled by Washington in the Stanley Cup final rematch, and then a night later were schooled by a Pittsburgh Penguins team without their starting goaltender. Of course, Matt Murray dealing with concussion issues, and you're right. They look like the team everyone thought they were going to be a year ago. Right? They look like a team that, right, you know, they look like an expansion team. It's just a year late, and it's a real listen. Gerard Gallant is a terrific coach. You know, he hasn't done what he's done, and not just last year. I think everyone recognizes he's a high-end NHL coach. So he didn't forget how to do that just in the space of the summer. So I think if there's a team that will be able to, you know, find its legs, it's the Vegas Golden Knights. But you're right, Pierre. They are probably as big a story, and on the negative side, as there has been in this early part. And I'm curious, you know, the guy, we had to pick you didn't do this because you didn't fill in the form, but we had to identify a disappointing team or a team that could disappoint. And I thought Anaheim was a team that, you know, especially with Corey Perry out. But boy, good for Randy Carlyle and John Gibson and the rest of the Ducks. What a nice start for a team that I think a lot of people were about ready to close the book on, and they're off to a terrific start in Anaheim. That's a really important, and I think that's important for them, given the strength of the California teams.
Yeah, no, a surprising start, and they don't have all their players. Obviously, Corey Perry's hurt, and Nick Ritchie, as we tape this, is still unsigned, and they got the kids in there, and Ryan Kessler's back, which is nice to see for him and for the Ducks. And really, the Ducks, I think, were a popular picked by a lot of people around the league to kind of regress this year, and that may still be the case, but nice surprising start for Anaheim.
All right, anything else?
Once again, I'd like to remind you that it's very insensitive of you to rebuff my trade offers for Ezekiel Elliott, given my fandom of the Dallas Cowboys. You need to address that if you are truly a friend of mine.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens between now and next week when we tape episode 6. I'll see if I can come. We'll let you know. I'm sure every week now people go, and I wonder if Burnside's going to trade. Well, and people probably know Craig Cousins is my partner in this league. So,
well, Craig refuses to trade with me because Craig's suspicious of me. So
he is suspicious of you. Well, he knows you. So, all right. Well, my friend, as always, a ton of fun to engage with you on Two Man Advantage, the podcast. We'll do it again next week, and have a great weekend.
All right. See you, pal.